most likely in a first meeting, you're gonna have 30 minutes. You'll spend 10 minutes hearing about the investor and their fund. You'll do intros. That leaves another 10 minutes and change for you really to get through whatever slides and demo you're gonna give. You know, it's imperative that you leave time at the end for questions and discussion around next steps and so on. And so you really, like, this is basic. You're being forced to take this story that you live every single day and compress it into something compact, but make sure that you do. Because if that 30 minutes comes up and you haven't closed on, you know, some sort of next step or understand their process or get their reactions, you know, it's a miss.
Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com.
Welcome back to the Capital Factory podcast. We have a very special guest today. We are going to hear from an entrepreneur who studied at University of Michigan, got an MBA at the University of California at Berkeley. So almost a Longhorn, comparable schools to UT, as close as you could get. Some great schools. I'm from Michigan. Go blue. But he's a seasoned revenue leader with experience at large companies like SAP, Workday, and WP Engine, which actually started here on this floor, big success story out of Capital Factory, primarily in sales and marketing roles. We'll dive into that. In 2023, he spun out of WP Engine to start Embrace.ai. We invested at Capital Factory, so proud portfolio company of ours, which is an AI tool to help with product support. And WP Engine was a flagship customer, one of their first customers, which is pretty good sign. So here to discuss driving LTV with AI, let's welcome Seth Halpern to the show. Welcome, Seth.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Don't appreciate it.
Seth, thanks for coming out.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Appreciate the invitation, and thanks for the warm intro.
2 years into driving your own startup, what's it like?
Yeah, it's, you know, it is, I think it's all the things that it's built to be. It's, you know, exciting, exhilarating. You know, there is never a dull moment. There are lots of twists and turns daily. And it's amazing to be able to, you know, have a high level of control and autonomy in terms of, you know, where we lead the company. We are, you know, a little over 2 years old. You know, it's myself and a co-founder. And there's a lot that we can move on really quickly as a small company, which, you know, I absolutely enjoy. You know, there's a never-ending set of things to tackle, you know, just as every startup. But it's unbelievably gratifying to, you know, win a new customer. It's, you know, even more gratifying to have that customer be successful and help, you know, tell our story, which is the place we're focused on right now. And it's been a great ride.
Awesome. Well, it's been awesome to watch you just from a distance, and excited to dive in here today and learn a little bit more. And there's a lot of directions we can go, but the topic of the hour is AI. Topic of the decade, or you know, I
big one right now.
Yeah, it's a big one. But and there's a lot of talk about AI writing code, picking up engineering workflows. But also another thing I've been hearing, and I think you've got a good insight on, is using AI on the revenue side of the business. And I've heard people even say that's where most of the rubber is hitting the road in the early days. But yeah, let's dive into that. I mean, from your perspective, as you know, coming from, you know, building hundreds of millions of dollars in business, when did you first see AI coming and start, you know, kind of taking it seriously as something that you're going to go lean into?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it started around this time 3 years ago. You know, roughly Thanksgiving 3 years ago was when, you know, ChatGPT came on the radar.
Yep. Possibly one of the most viral product releases ever to happen.
Absolutely.
And just totally.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a rocket ship, yeah. And it's, you know, my mom knows what ChatGPT is. Like, it's just part of, like, the lexicon of, you know, anybody who interfaces with technology. And so for me, that was a moment that felt a lot like other big transformations in enterprise technologies in the past. I've lived through the move to enterprise cloud. Really formative part of my career I spent at Workday, very early days at that company. As companies weren't sure whether they wanted to put their people data in the cloud or not. I felt like I was seeing the movie again, which was like major platform shifts, which represents all kinds of tremendous opportunities. And, at the same time, I was living certain challenges that I can see in my role at WP Engine, who later, went on to become our first customer, that felt addressable with AI. So, there was the combination of like major tectonic shifts in technology, which felt like, real and tangible and transformational, even though that was like GPT-3 maybe at that point in time. But you could feel already that it was powerful. It was going to have a huge level of impact. I had a potential co-founder who would be like basically my number one pick to be a co-founder, Derek Butts, who's in the Bay Area, who I've known for 15 years, to working very closely together at Workday. He was the right person with some really good complementary skills. And it felt like the timing was right to bring AI into enterprises in different ways. And over the course of, a series of quarters, we went, from landing like some really early customers to decide on honing into where we are right now, which is product support for B2B companies.
Yep. We'll dive into that in a second. I see that there's kind of two sides. One's, driving LTV by acquiring new customers, and then the other is by getting more value out of your old customers and keeping them around longer. But let's start first with acquiring new customers. I mean, if you're a venture-backed tech company or want to be a venture-backed tech company, how should you be thinking about using AI to get customers?
Yeah, I think there's a number of ways to potentially leverage AI. The places that we're leaning into, one, are just around content. As a small company, you need to do things that can scale and increase your visibility and exposure in the marketplace. And part of that is content, whether it's on our website, via blog posts, on LinkedIn, through case studies, etc. Like all of that is scalable and can help, provide beneficial impacts in terms of SEO and other things. There are really powerful use cases around content for early stage companies. And that's like whether you're using ChatGPT or we use our products, really heavily for content creation, editing, etc. But my co-founder often will just record himself talking. Like there'll be a particular topic we want to build a blog post around. He'll record himself talking for a period of time, take that recording, load it into Embrace, and that can become a baseline of basically unstructured content that can be turned into something that's much more scalable. I use it to write content in different ways as well. And it just helps you go a whole lot faster. Yeah. And, I think, for companies, it's deciding what's sort of the human component, what's the AI component, and, what's the right balance in terms of new content generation. That's certainly one.
Well, and before we move on to two, I mean, content is king, as they say. And what's interesting is it helps create content at all these different levels, whether you're just writing an email, a blog post, a social post. It's, we're doing similar. We think your co-founder does his audio recordings. That's how we think of this podcast. Mm-hmm. And it's, we kind of always had this high level view of our ecosystem. And through this, we're recording these deeper stories of what the entrepreneurs are doing. And then we get all that, into our database. And we think there's things we can do, one, from a marketing standpoint, but also for us, like from a portfolio standpoint, and really understanding who's doing interesting things, who we can, who we should introduce to who for various reasons. And, content is king. And the other thing that's coming, I don't know if I haven't seen it generally like production level yet or used, but is video content, AI video. Have you guys started messing with any of that?
We haven't gone down that path
yet. Yeah.
We'll potentially use our product capabilities to write the scripts for that content.
Yeah.
But the production, we're still doing ourselves.
Still,
but absolutely see, hear, read about, you know, you've got just emerging and seemingly really powerful in your content creation. Yeah.
If you watch the podcast, you'll see some less than stellar AI impressions of me at certain points, reading ads, things like that. But seeing myself as an AI was such a just light bulb moment. And seeing, you know, I immediately thought of the phrase from Steve Jobs, like, your iPhone's an extension of yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, your AI will be an extension of yourself. And this is something that not just for companies, for people, will play in. And I don't know exactly the implications, but I knew it was like, wow, this is, I was actually on sabbatical when Aaron played the video of me to a whole company. And I started getting messages. I didn't even know what was going on. But I was out there, you know, or something that kind of had my likeness was out there doing
totally.
Doing
things, no, I mean, so. It's like simultaneously like amusing and a look into the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of ways to make it feel like a reflection of you or the brand of the company or the style of the, you know, the individual that's represented. Because there's, you know, there are mechanisms to leverage, like, your brand tone and voice, like, your, you know, provide, you know, really custom instructions about how it should behave, so it doesn't just feel like, you know, a generic AI output.
Okay, so content. What was the second or third piece around acquiring new customers?
Yeah, so you know, we have been leaning into, you know, a popular technology called Clay.
Mm-hmm. That's new to me.
So. Clay, you know, in sort of the outbound marketing world, has become, you know, a fairly popular mechanism to do what I describe as personalization at scale, right? And so there is, you know, enrichment capabilities that Clay has access to. It can, you know, understand who your target audiences are and help craft fairly personalized messages for them. And, you know, it's a company that's, you know, grown really significantly over, you know, they've been around for, I don't know, 5+ years. But, you know, we're using that as a mechanism to do broad-based outbound. Our market is big. You know, we're not yet a household name. And so for us, connecting at scale to, like, a really identifiable set of buyers, mm-hmm. which are often, like, support, leaders, chief customer officers, at a, you know, companies of a certain profile, like, we can identify them, find them, and then target them with messages that feel personalized, but, you know, across, you know, large prospect set.
Yeah.
So Clay is... You know, that's another technology that's worth looking at, you know, to help on the new customer acquisition front.
So it deepens the effectiveness of digital marketing, where you kind of had, you know, the advent of digital marketing of 10, 20 years ago that allowed us to target these specific groups in unique ways. Now you can, you know, go 10 times better by finding those same groups, but having messages that are personalized to each person within it.
Absolutely.
Got it.
So that's been helpful for us. And, you know, I think the, I think, you know, there, you know, there's an opportunity for companies to engage more deeply, you know, on the, like, on the sales as, you know, or AI as sales front. I think we're at a place where we want to engage one-on-one with our prospects. Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, we're hands-on. There's AI that we provide them capability to access during our engagement with them to be able to get answers. But, you know, I think for us, just being able to, you know, engage in a human way with our prospects helps us build deeper relationships and so on.
Yep, absolutely. At scale, key point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that the third piece, or was there a third
one? Yeah, you know, that's like, the third piece is just, like, you know, how do you engage, like, day-to-day with prospects? We have customers, so our central use case is around support. We have customers who have fairly technical products and fairly technical buyers, and, like, the sales teams themselves are not deeply technical. Like, that's not an uncommon sort of combination. And so for those customers of ours, we're providing them access to Embrace so that they can get answers to questions that are, you know, they're getting from prospects on a call or via email, to be able to provide, you know, deep, accurate technical answers to all the questions that they face. That you know, especially for less tenured sellers, they may not sort of have built into their talk tracks yet.
Right. So they can.
So just enablement.
Right. Enabling your sales team to get up to speed faster, acquire that company knowledge faster.
Yes.
You know, get there, perform high.
Yeah, those customers will take like sales enablement content, you know, their website content, objection handling docs, persona docs, put them into a collection, and then, you know, which is like a, you know, basically an aggregation of digital content that our customers assemble, and then tap into that content with Slack, which is, you know, where a lot of sales teams are naturally engaging. And getting information, they can ask questions of Embrace, like in and get answers in real time via Slack versus waiting on somebody else to respond.
Awesome. All right. So on the acquire new customer, we had content is key and Clay, outbound marketing using Clay was a tool. And then this idea of engaging on a daily basis in a personal way with your customers on an ongoing cadence. All right. And then let's shift gears to how AI can help support existing customers and how it can help support piece. And it's like a very layman's observation, but a seasoned sales leader and, you know, probably your whole life, is there ever a time where you don't want more support for your product? And I could just kind of, I mean, I don't want to assume what went through your mind, but it's like, oh, wow, this tool, I'm going to go create something that solves this big problem I've always wanted is, you know, more support.
Yeah, we built our business around exactly this, which is a really clear, tangible, realizable use case for generative AI. And, you know, every company we talk to, regardless of size, has information about their products. Like it may be as simple as an FAQ doc. Oftentimes it's a knowledge base that sits in, you know, Zendesk or Notion or Confluence or Silverbeat. Oftentimes it's a combination of like many different places. So the content exists for an end customer to get answers or for a support tech to get answers, but it's been difficult historically to tap into that. And so whether a company is like 50,000 people or 50 people, they're all wrestling with a version of this. So, you know, this is like the thesis behind Embrace is there's an opportunity to really up level support. We're focused on B2B companies. And whether it is for a support tech and a support team to gain scale, or the customers of our customers to provide a self-service experience, which is useful, valuable, and is a real alternative to like the traditional library of articles that, you know, has, you know, is difficult to navigate and digest. You know, these are places where we're seeing a lot of uptake. And I think it's been really interesting to observe. Companies are at different stages in terms of their life cycle with adopting AI. And a relatively early frontier for companies is this, how do we support like and provide a better post-sales experience to our customers who like don't, you know, sometimes they want to talk to a person and they should be able to talk to a person if they have a particularly complex issue, if it's something where, you know, they really need to tap into a certain level of expertise. But that isn't necessarily their desire. They want an answer. They want to be able to resolve their issue. Yeah. And they want to be able to do it, you know, quickly on what, you know, whatever hour, if it's, you know, Sunday at 2 a.m, they want to be able to get answers to questions about the product that they've signed up to use. And so there's this really interesting combination of like a business case, you know, this like, A support meets AI use case is highly quantifiable. Our customers have quantified it in terms of, you know, like avoided tickets or scale for their, you know, their support team members. And all those things, you know, matter in an environment where companies are making very thoughtful, like, buying decisions. But it's not just about that. It's about the customer experience, which all of a sudden, you know, we're seeing companies not only realize a business case, but also see like an improvement in CSAT, an improvement in like the metrics that they use to measure how their, you know, the quality of their customers' interactions. Mm-hmm. Our perspective, and this ties to like this topic as a whole, is it's all about customer lifetime value. And our reason for being is to, you know, help companies drive up customer lifetime value, which, you know, ties directly to, you know, company value and so on. And so if you can provide a great experience to your users and customers, they're much more likely to like renew, expand, introduce you to people that they know, like be a referral point, all of the things that, you know, that you want as a company. You know, it's, you know, it takes a lot of work and a lot of cost to land that next new customer. It's much more efficient to grow the ones that you have and keep them on board, drive, you know, NRR, GR, et cetera. And so there's a huge opportunity now to like, yes, like achieve some of the scalability benefits of this use case, but also just like drive a really powerful customer experience. And that could be like, you know, for our customers in their product or on a help site, like you mentioned, you know, WP Engine, that was customer number one for us. You know, if you go to wpengine.com/support, you know, that's their public support center, and Embrace is on that center and it's helping provide answers, you know, at scale to their customer base and even their non-customer base because it's ungated. We're, you know, we're in their portal experience, but also their entire support team is leveraging Embrace to be able to get answers faster, answer tickets faster. You know, we have apps for Slack, for Zendesk, for Jira Service Management, for Salesforce, for the places where like support teams are working. You know, we're working hard to bring Embrace to them so that they could answer the next ticket with like quality and efficiency both.
So it's, on one hand, this is probably the obvious piece that just allows your existing support team to handle more tickets.
Yes.
And if you're a fast growing company, you got to hire a lot of people, that takes a little bit of the load off of scaling that team because each person you hire can do. But there's also this opportunity to provide more, a better experience, more value to the customer by implementing these tools as well. So it's more efficient and you create more value for, for your
customers. And, you know, on the first point, like, you know, for sure there's the opportunity to handle more tickets and scale, but also for those like level one support techs that are handling many of the same questions over and over again,
right?
It gets them out of the, you know, the business of having to repeatedly answer them like, you know, how do I add a user? How do I log in, et cetera? You know, we have a customer, a company called Simplicity that just published a case study with us that talked about their support techs now like having more of a revenue mindset and thinking about, you know, how to allocate some time towards revenue generating opportunities with their customer base in like conjunction with the sales team. And so some of it is about how do you just continually up level and have even more impact from the support teams that are in place.
Incredible. And then the self-service piece, that's kind of what you see at wpengine.com/support, or kind of walk me through, like, where are you able to turn something that used to require light touch into a self-service situation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're a great example where, you know, historically they had what most companies have, which is a really in-depth library of articles. And think about any sort of help center you've ever gone to with a technology, you know, product that has a search bar, and you type in a question, and you get returned a list of articles. And hopefully, like, one of those articles is on point. But one way or the other, like, you have to read, digest multiple articles. And a lot of times companies or users will just say, I don't have the time. I'm going to open up a ticket or take whatever action to, like, escalate to a human. That's been the approach historically, not just for WP Engine, but many, many other companies. And it's still the MO for many companies. If you go think about any enterprise products you're using, go to their help center, type in response. My guess is 4 times out of 5, you're going to get a list of articles, which is exciting for us because it represents significant opportunity. So, you know, WP Engine has like on that site, and then also with their within their portal, like for their existing customers, have placed Embrace so that their users can get answers. And what that's translated to for them is a 45% improvement in self-service success. So, you know, users in there are 45%, you know, more likely to get an answer instead of like opening a chat or creating a ticket, et cetera. And so for them, it's been this great combo of like business case plus addressing a need from their customer base. Keller Williams is another good example of one of our customers where you know, they have 150,000 plus agents that are part of their franchise network. And they've provided self-service to those agents within their own technology properties. And, you know, for them, it's, you know, it's help up-level the experience, unlock tremendous, like, content about all kinds of offerings that Keller has, and be able to do it in a, like, a meaningful way that, you know, they've won awards for around just being AI forward. They published a case study with us, and that's another example.
Very good. Very good. I always like to end around fundraising, and you've had some success here raising some money. Any, you know, pro tips for entrepreneurs out there that they should keep in mind while raising money?
Yeah, totally. So I would, you know, I would say whatever sort of pitch deck and approach you start with, think about it as you haven't poured concrete. Like, it's a starting point that you want to spend a lot of time building the plan around. Yeah. And like, you know, what's the story that we want to tell? How do we want to tell it in a, like, a polished, professional, concise way? But very likely you will start to realize there are questions you didn't anticipate that will start to come up from people you're presenting it to. And having a mindset around, like, iteration and continuous improvement, I think is really important. Yeah. So, you know, the first version of the deck that you know we use versus where we finished were quite different because we realized there were certain questions that we needed to address, and it's better, I think, in a lot of cases to proactively address a point because you're most likely in a first meeting you're gonna have 30 minutes. Every once in a while it might be longer, but it's, you know, you're going to have 30 minutes and you need to bank on no more than that. So the more questions you can address versus having them ask the question and having that consume time, it's really helpful. I would also say, in general, like, plan to use the time really efficiently. Like, you'll get a sense of the rhythm of these discussions, the first discussions in particular. You'll spend 10 minutes hearing about the investor and their fund. Mm-hmm. You'll do intros. That leaves another 10 minutes and change for you really to get through whatever slides and demo you're going to give. And you know, it's imperative that you leave time at the end for questions and discussion around next steps and so on. And so you really, like, this is basic, but can be easily overlooked because we're all really excited about, like, our product, our company, you know, and it's, you're being forced to take this story that you live every single day and compress it into something compact, but make sure that you do, because if that 30 minutes comes up and, you know, the investor needs to go to their next call, which is often the case, and you haven't closed on, you know, some sort of next step or understand their process or get their reactions, you know, it's a miss.
Yeah.
So those are a couple things. An entrepreneur told me some advice early on, which was, you know, it's about introductions to investors. And so, like, you know, Capital Factory is, like, the best game in town for helping answer this question that you've asked of me. And it has a network of, you know, tremendous investing capacity here in town through not just Capital Factory, but, you know, local funds, angel investors, et cetera. So, you know, you guys do this every day. But the intro to the investor really matters, right? And who it comes from, can have a huge level of impact. So, like, the best case was, you know, get an intro from a founder at a company that successfully exited, like, via, like, the particular firm. You know, and then from there, it's like an invest, you know, a founder in their portfolio. And then it's, you know, it's a founder who, you know, may have a connection to them, et cetera, et cetera. Going in cold, like, can work, but it's really tough. I mean, you know, VCs are barraged. Like, their time is they're just always time constrained. Yeah. And so they're going to look for a warm intro and prioritize it above everything else. And so find ways to get warm introductions through folks, you know, in your network, whether they're other investors or entrepreneurs or customers, it's pretty essential.
Yeah, absolutely. So three things I'd unpack there. One is iterate on your materials, on your narrative,
always been the case in a fast-moving world like AI, probably even more so. And when you go out to market, the first 5, 10, 20 meetings you take, you're going to discover some new questions mm-hmm. that maybe you weren't prepared and build those into your deck moving forward so you don't have to waste time answering questions or spend time answering questions on that topic. Two, I thought it was a good one that I see entrepreneurs is leave time for discussion at the end. And, you know, if you're pitching right up to the end of the call, no bueno, and you're not gonna get what you need out of the meeting, which is some inkling of feedback from this investor and hopefully a next step. Mm-hmm. Third is give a solid intro, which mm-hmm. we talk a lot about around here. And you know, a lot of ways VCs are like they're looking for reasons to say no. Seth introduced me to a company. I can't say no to that meeting. You know, he's very important. I'm going to take it every single time, even if I'm not going to take a meeting. I might take the meeting if it's not a fit for Capital Factory, but I would probably preface that a little bit, but I'd still take the meeting and meet the entrepreneur. Yes. Excellent. Well, thank you for entertaining my questions.
Yeah, of course.
We appreciate it. Let's open it up to our audience here. Who's got a question for Seth?
Yeah.
Let's go Val.
Yeah, I have two questions. First, the product. I think that the knowledge base of the company is the biggest problem which we can fix today with AI. And I spent, I don't know how many months to find solutions. So I know everything about like all the companies which try to fix this. And some companies who have this data, like Google Drive, like Microsoft, or ClickUp, Notion, they try to do this internally in the product. They have some connection with external solution and data as well. And other guys like Zendesk, Zohardesk, and all these like support stuff, they try to do the same in, I guess, 8 years before. So my question, how do you see, because it's crowd and I could not find any excellent solution today. So what do you see like an excellent future vision for knowledge base with AI for most companies?
Yeah, I think, we see similar dynamics to you in terms of like lots of different solutions that are out there that house knowledge, whether they're intended as a knowledge base or otherwise. I think the future one is, there's still a company mindset, which is around the knowledge base, because that's how companies have operated to date. It's, I need a complete and thorough knowledge base with structured, formatted articles. The reality is, I think over a handful of years, that historic knowledge base, like artifact, is going to become less important because AI is so adept at handling unstructured data. Right, you don't really need like a beautifully formatted, perfect, article to present to an end customer. You need that knowledge to be able to answer questions. So, I think there'll be an evolution, which is being able to take in unstructured data. Like we tap into if our customers would like, we tap into select Slack channels they have because a lot of answers surface in Slack. So a customer can bring their Slack channel or Slack channels into Embrace alongside with Confluence, Notion, et cetera, content. So one is like structured versus unstructured data. I think two, a place we've really focused on is being agnostic to any of those sources. And I think some of the companies that you've mentioned are not, their knowledge base is the center of the universe.
Yeah.
And for us, it doesn't matter, which is why, we have a pre-built integration to the Zendesk knowledge base. We have one to Notion, to Confluence. We have the ability to bring in Jira tickets and Zendesk tickets and lots of other sources because it all matters. And so we want to be able to aggregate and tap into it. And I think the third piece is you maybe touched on a little bit was like the ability to identify gaps, which every company has. Doesn't matter how robust their knowledge team is, products evolve, they change, there's releases that are coming out constantly. And so companies are wrestling with knowledge gaps. We identify knowledge gaps, we help companies understand, where they are. And then we're also tapping into other sources of content that can provide new knowledge content. So imagine if you can spot a knowledge gap, you know that somebody has answered a Zendesk ticket or engineering has handled a Jira ticket that's actually answered the question, but right now it's a gap. So we can, you know, we have tools that we give our AI agents that can tap into Zendesk and Jira closed tickets and be able to use that as a source to construct a new article and close that gap. So those are a few pieces.
Yeah. And yeah, it's very maybe important because too hard to build all this like excellent clean up knowledge base, and I know zero company to build this. That's why maybe nobody don't want to do this like routine and boring stuff. But it's cool. Another question, it's like too complimentary for Nick's question about fundraising. So if you're talking about pre-seed and seed round, and talking about like Capital Factory in Austin and Silicon Valley, because I saw the over 50% of pre-seed investments Silicon Valley gave, and another 50%, less only 50% all the like US. So what do you recommend to do for pre-seed companies? Need they build some connection with Silicon Valley, with New York and then other markets, and try to be here as well, like for Austin-based companies? Or you can raise money just only in Austin or in Texas, and it's fine, and you can do this from angel round, or seed, seed, and so on. Because seed looks like much easier than pre-seed because too hard to find someone here.
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's always good to have options and to be able to, you know, tap into different pools of capital. And you know, what I would say, you know, I've been in Austin for a little over, you know, 20 years, which is, you know, not to say I grew up here, but I've been here long enough to see certain arcs. And where the local community is compared to where it started when I first got here is worlds apart. You obviously have like you have Capital Factory as like an example. We're sitting in their offices. The organization is, you know, is thriving and having an impact in a lot of different ways. And you have many early stage venture funds that have, you know, generally like a headquarters here or a presence here. And that's very, very different than you know, existence certainly when I got here, which, you know, there's a lot of centralization around like, you know, a very short list of funds that were operating at that time. So you have a growing ecosystem, you have Bay Area companies that are more apt to do investment here in Austin, which, you know, has not always been the case. I think, you know, what you have in the Bay Area are, you know, there just are more funds and there are more dollars to deploy. You know, that like there's, you know, all the data will show you that. There are also more local companies that are vying for those dollars. I do think, you know, this is, I believe, a good community to raise like a pre-seed round in. You know, and some of it depends on the size of the pre-seed, but like you have the combination of firms that really like are interested in doing pre-seed, if like Capital Factory can help navigate to some of those. You also have like this cohort of just like early stage angel investors that can help fill out a pre-seed round. So I don't, you know, if you're here raising in town, you know, there's going to be some benefits to it, and you're going to have investors that are going to want to, you know, to invest in local founders. And I know there are funds here that, you know, I like traded emails recently with, you know, one of the most prominent firms in town that I made an intro to, a person who wasn't totally sure where they were going to settle, whether it was going to be Austin or somewhere else. And, the investor was really dead set on having, you know, Texas-based founders. And so you have the benefit of being in town, which, you know, can give you some advantages. But, you know, in our case, you know, I'm here, my co-founder's in the Bay Area, we can tap into like both networks and communities and, you know, get the best of both worlds. So I would just say, like, keep your options open. I'm a pragmatist. Just, you know, be pragmatic about the approach.
And I would add, in
Austin's unique in that it's one of these cities where the San Francisco, New York, these coastal investors, they're interested in Austin and they will invest here, and they are, even if they're not. And so definitely great local ecosystem, but you know, I would be targeting any investor and really trying to find investors that, like, more thematically, if you're, you know, selling into enterprise software, like, you know, who are those investors? If there's a specific industry, be more agnostic to location. But given the choice, I'd pick a local investor because they're here. But I wouldn't not. I would 100% be building network in New York and San Francisco, and there's people all over the world really that are looking at Austin for investment. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
You know, talking about bigger, more established companies that are, you know, right now as AI is getting to a point where it's, like, actually more than good enough to handle a lot of workflows, like, what departments or specific workflows do you think, and obviously can vary by industry, but do you think can have, like, the more quicker ROI from actually implementing AI? I mean, apart from support.
Yeah, totally. I think places where companies have seen a lot of uptake, certainly on the coding side. You know, I think our engineering organization, you know, most engineering organizations are leaning into various tools to help on the coding front. That, you know, that is an easy to deploy, like, proven use case. That can take advantage of, you know, there's a whole slew of, you know, tools out there. Some are that are, you know, very high profile, you know, but there's a range that are out there. You know, there are, like, you know, very, like, marketing specific tools that are out there. I know that, like, there's, you know, Jasper here in town, you know, historically, but there are others that are really, you know, honed in on, you know, a particular use case tied to, like, you know, marketing for you know, extensive marketing organizations that need, you know, very specialized capabilities. You know, you've got you know, marketing. You know, there are, I think there's, you know, this evolution that's going to happen where AI capabilities are now and where they'll be, will begin to unlock additional use cases that are out there. The models are going to continue to improve. The models will become, you know, I think in general, the LLMs as large language models are really good at human language. But I think, you know, we'll reach a place where AI can have a deeper impact as it relates to, like, quantitative analysis and questions, engagement that people have that's much more data-driven, which, you know, I think is not at the same place as its, you know, AI's capabilities with language, generally speaking, you know, for the public LLM providers. There are a lot of places where AI will go, but the, you know, right in the here and now, I think as companies are looking to, like, for tangible use cases, it's like, it is support. Like, I'm biased, but I think genuinely, like, it's a really tangible use case that companies are having success around. It's like content generation and creation, and it's, you know, coding are a few, like, really prominent examples.
I would call out, like, kind of, you touched on it, but just another frame is, like, everything, like, 0 to 1 you can use AI for. And, like, mm-hmm. if you're just starting out and you're semi-technical, you don't even know how to code, but, you know, you got to be able to use software tools. You can, you know, use, you know, Cursor for writing code or other tools to get your first MVP out, marketing, all these things, versus before, you had to go get a graphic designer, you had to get a developer, and, like, those were just unavoidable costs that now, just thinking back when I was a student, it's like, man, I would have been able to really go so much further with these.
It's a great point. Yeah. It's a mindset shift that I think a user has to go through in terms of what's capable. Like, a very simple example that I would give is, I might go, you know, ask an AI tool, like, if I'm creating an outbound email campaign, give me best practices in terms of how should my subject line read? And then I'll think about it and say, well, why do I need to ask that question? Why don't I just, you know, put in a more elaborate prompt, describe who I am, my company, what we're trying to achieve, and say, give me 10 subject lines. And so I like a super simple example, but I think just continuing to think through like the next order of what's possible with AI is hugely valuable. I mean, you know, I'll use it for, you know, for us, what systems our prospects use really matter. In particular, their ticketing system. Like, you know, many of our customers and prospects use Zendesk as an example. They use other ticketing systems as well, but, you know, Zendesk has been a particularly popular like profile. I want to know when I'm getting on a call with a prospect, are they using Zendesk or not? And they're, you know, if you do like in-depth analysis, like you can see code on their site. You can look at like people's LinkedIn profiles, how they describe themselves. Maybe they talk about, you know, the ticketing system. You can see job postings that are out there. Like you can generally figure it out. And AI for us can help us like accelerate for a given prospect. Like, tell me what ticketing system they use. And by the way, like I also want to know, does engineering use Jira? Because we have a really good story for that. Are they a Slack shop or a Team shop? Like we can help with either one, but you know, what are they using? Are they using like Confluence or Notion? Like I want to know their landscape, and AI can help there. So I think like, you know, whether it's, you know, using Embrace or like literally like a $20 ChatGPT subscription, there's a huge amount of lift. Your point is a great one, Nick. Like as an early stage company, like you have to be a generalist. Mm-hmm. I'm responsible at my company for like sales, marketing, customer success.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those things are a team sport for us as a company, but we don't have a lot of specialization. And so just being able to tackle more fast and, you know, really like capital efficient way, AI can provide a lot of mileage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe one more question for anybody, Lucy?
My question is similar like Wells. So first question about your tool, really. So you can connect to their CRM system, for example, Yavris. People decide the questions with their customers.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So how can you control, for example, if we are talking about this knowledge base, if we have articles, it's great. It's like your like standards, what you need to do. But if we connect to all conversations and we see how people, especially we say about big company, somebody can decide question maybe not right way, but it will come to their knowledge base. How can you to understand that this is correct way, this is incorrect way? Because if it will compare, add to the knowledge system and will change our articles, what we wrote before, it could be wrong way.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So, I mean, the way we control for it is by having a human in the loop, right? So we are not, while we help with the automated generation of those articles, we're not like pushing those articles without any sort of vetting into the knowledge base. So our customer plays a role in terms of validating the content. Because, you know, sometimes you have situations with like conflicting source data, and you want to have like an expert who's actually, you know, vetting the article. So one is, we have that as a measure to make sure that there's not just this blind sort of push into the knowledge base. The second approach that we take is our users, like, you know, in terms of like support text, can provide feedback to the answers that they're receiving, right? So if you're a support tech and you're answering like tickets, and you're drawing from all the sources that I mentioned before, and Embrace gives a response that feels like mostly right, but actually like is not completely right because of this release that just came out recently, then the user can, you know, hit a feedback button. They can input feedback, within their ticketing environment, and that flows to a centralized triage point where, you know, the right person is monitoring all those feedback points and they're either dispositioning themselves or they're assigning to somebody else who's an expert to like assess, close the gap, you know, if needed, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's human in the loop at the right points along the way.
So almost it's a specialist what you provide who will check this, right?
It's like some internal customer expert.
Or product expert. Okay. So, you know, where we're providing lift is streamlining the creation of the knowledge content, right? Which is, you know, writing for most people is just hard. And, you know, it's, you know, I know I need to create these X number of articles, but I've got a blank sheet of paper and there's like 50 other things I want to do. or I need to do. And so it's hard to get started. And so for us, it's like, we'll draft the article using, you know, internal company proprietary sources, but there is a, you know, an expert, a product expert, a support expert, maybe somebody from product management, like somebody, an SC, somebody who has expertise that can decide, you know, whether to take the article as is or make adjustments to it.
Thank you. And the second question, about the raising money. So you say that you have your partner in San Francisco and all most of your investition from Austin and San Francisco, yeah?
We're headquartered in Austin. Okay. We have critical mass of people in Austin. You know, my co-founder, our AI lead, are in the Bay Area. And then we have a distributed team that's in other cities around the country. We have some developers in Krakow, Poland, and so we're working in a distributed way.
Why ask? When we raised money and spoke with different investors here, we spoke with, for example, Dallas investors, Austin's, and less with the old California. And what we know, for example, all investors from Dallas and from Austin, they're different. And if we say about investors from Silicon Valley, they're different too. So what is your maybe advice? When I say about their difference, they want to hear different things about your product, how it will grow, how it will for the future, what they want to see in your deck and your product and so on. So what is your advice? How is better? What better to say? What about better to say with this master from, for example, Austin, Silicon Valley, and maybe another one area what you used the most?
Something to be mindful of is who's seeing what deals at a given point in time. You have more software companies in the Bay Area than anywhere else in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so Bay Area investors are going to see, you know, all the hot software companies, and whoever's in market or recently, you know, raised is going to be a data point that they have, because they probably talked to that company, maybe they invested in them, but they saw their pitch. In Austin, like, I don't know that the almost like the deal flow is quite as high. They're going to see different deals. They're less apt to see, or less likely to see, Bay Area companies, like full Bay Area companies here in Austin, because those companies are probably just going to raise in the Bay Area. And so, you know, I've made this point before, but I think the markets just have trade-offs. What they're looking for, it may vary depending on the themes of the investors. Mm-hmm. There is a growing and meaningful, like, you know, software ecosystem that's here in town, like, for sure. It's, again, just like the investing community has evolved, the entrepreneurial community has evolved, and we're in, like, a totally different place than 20-odd years ago, which is fantastic. But there just are fewer software companies here in town. There's maybe less efficiency in this market. Because you have, you know, fewer investors than you have in the Bay Area. I don't know. There's no, like, silver bullet in terms of how to answer your question. Like, from my own experience talking about Bay Area and Austin investors, it depends on the person, okay. Depends on the firm. You'll get a pretty good sense of their focus. I mean, this was like another learning, you know, for me. Was really there are differences from the firm, and one VC and another VC can be totally different. And so, I try to really dial in, like, what stage do they invest in? Like, this is a basic one, but they're, you know, whether it's on their website or in the first call you have with them, you're gonna get a read, like, do they do pre-seed, seed, and A with a bias towards pre-seed and seed? Are they, do they do, like, seed A and beyond, but they actually want to write bigger checks at later stage deals? Do they want to lead? Like, most firms will want to lead. But sometimes you have ones that are, you know, their MO is to be, like, a more of a passive investor, and they'll participate, but they don't want to lead. What are the check sizes that they're looking to write? Which for you, like, ties to, you know, the equity that you're going to sell in your company through a raise. And, you know, are you looking to raise enough money where they're a good fit? Or do they write smaller checks and you're interested in? Do they write bigger checks and you're interested in? And so I, you know, and I'm happy to, like, be a resource, like, after this conversation. But I think really, like, knowing who the investor is can help you get a read, and seeing, like, what's in their portfolio, what's their background, personally, can get a read on what might matter most to them.
A couple things I'd add. You know, first thing is stay true to your vision as an entrepreneur, and if you change your pitch to match what an investor wants, they might invest in you, and then you're stuck building someone else's vision that's not your vision because you changed it. And you kind of need to find who's there. The other part that is that I found is the easiest, like, objective thing to dig into is the size of the fund that the investor is investing out of. I think at a high level there are philosophical differences, but I won't get into those. But just in general, look, the Austin VCs are like $250 million and smaller funds, maybe a little bigger. Broad strokes, there's exceptions, but that's what I see. And then in Silicon Valley, they're investing out of these billion-dollar funds, multi-billion-dollar funds, right? And so VCs making investments, looking at companies that have the potential to return the fund and drive the returns that they owe their investors, or trying to drive for their investors, is generally 3x their fund size, right? And so if I have a $1 billion fund, I'm looking for an investment that I can get $3 billion at the end of the day out of, right? And they're probably going to own 30% of your company, so you got to have like a $10 billion exit, right? And that's what you need to be honed in on and have a story for. If it's a $100 million fund, they're looking for investments that can return $300 million or potentially, you know, even less if it's, you know, smaller. You know, and so that tends to lean towards less of like a big moonshot pitch and more of like, what's the market play? How do we grow revenue? What's your traction? And, you know, getting more to this, you know, $500 million outcome, also super, super big and hard to do. But much different stories, much different trajectory. So I think like that's my starting point. It's like, okay, what's the size of this fund? And then, you know, everything Seth said, and just really knowing who these investors are and trying to find the ones that believe the same thing about, one, the future that you do, and then also how you're going to build this business into that future, right? Like, what's the path to get to that future? And it's not easy, especially your first time. Like, after you kind of build some investors and you know the market, it's you kind of know who to go pitch and how people think. But the first time, it's a little bit like, you know, walking through the forest.
I would just say, like, complete plus one to the point that you made around font size, which I should have mentioned I didn't. You know, there's this, like, tranche of funds that everybody knows. You know, A16Z and Benchmark and Sequoia and, like, very prominent Bay Area firms that have, like, a lot of cachet and history and bring out for, you know, lots of, like, good reasons. But I think, like, your point is dead on, which is, like, there are a ton of smaller funds out there that actually can be a better fit for earlier stage companies, because those big players have to write big checks. Like, they really, you know, they have to deploy much bigger pools of capital. And, you know, if you find, like, a, you know, $100 to $250 million fund, and there are a lot of them out there, some of whom you've never heard of but have, like, amazing general partners, and a really good track record, it means that they can write a smaller check that may be just right for you for your stage and be very happy with it. Because they're going to have a number of investments that they're going to look to make over the course of, like, the life of a fund. And they're going to have a typical check size. And so it's like, it just becomes this, like, math problem, basically. And I would advocate for considering, like, you know, smaller funds as a really interesting place to potentially raise.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Seth, on that note, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
I appreciate the invite, and I loved, you know, chatting with all of you. And I'm happy to be a resource coming out of today. And I will say, you know, I've spent a lot of time like just vetting different solutions that are in the market. If people want to reach out, like I may have ideas around like agencies or technologies or things that may be valuable to you all. If you're looking to make a decision around something to like up-level your capabilities internally.
What's the best way to reach out?
Just seth@embrace.ai.
Awesome.
Or ping me on LinkedIn.
Cool, awesome. Thank you, Seth.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out capitalfactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, nickspiller@capitalfactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode.